Funding for Think comes from SMU's Informal Courses for Adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is violence? While many of us think first of damaging physical force, my guest today says focusing on the subjective violence of crime and terrorism makes it too easy to overlook systemic and objective violence, like the government and economic systems and racism and hate speech that catalyze physical aggression. Slavoj Žižek is professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. He offers six sideways reflections in his new book, Violence. Slavoj, welcome to Think.
Thanks very much. Here I am. Pleasure to be here.
Can you begin by explaining for us how you define the term violence?
I am on purpose not very precise. I know there are distinctions between violence, authority, and so on and so on. My point is a very simple one. When we hear, as you just correctly said, when you hear the word violence, you automatically associate it with what I call subjective violence. That is, say, violence perpetrated by clearly identifiable agents, individuals, state apparatuses, crazy mob, or whatever. But what about things which we do experience as violence, as a traumatic upheaval of our normal life, but that we cannot attribute to a clear agent? Violence which is just an almost invisible part of how things are going on. Think from earthquake to economic catastrophes to violence inscribed into our very means of communication. And my task is not to claim that then all the blame can be put onto these more objective forms of violence, so the terrorists are not guilty of anything, and so on and so on. My point is just that in order precisely to properly understand the forms of violence which are visible to all of us, one should take into account also this more systemic violence, because the visible forms of violence are often a counteraction, reaction to this invisible violence, which is why, ironically, I refer to this objective and symbolic invisible forms of violence as dark matter of violence. In the same way as we know, in order to account for how the visible matter functions in our universe, physicists come to the conclusion that one has to take into account the so-called dark matter, invisible matter.
So before we understood that dark matter even existed, we had a fundamental concept of what matter was, but we couldn't fully explore what it really meant.
Yeah, and it's exactly the same here. Of course, we have a spontaneous understanding of what violence is, when somebody beats you and so on and so on. But to give you the thrust of my book, what interests me is how sometimes, even when violence in its direct physical form is not done, the violent effect can be even worse, even more shattering. And what especially fascinates me is how often not doing something can be experienced as a violent shock. Because, you know, for the things to stay the way they are, many activities has to go on permanently. So if you just withdraw and do nothing, it can seriously disturb the normal run of things. So again, I don't have a big positive idea or concept in my book. My point is just to shatter a little bit the people out of their complacent everyday view that we know how things are, whom to fight, and so on.
So if you were to do nothing, essentially what you would do is take away the power of entities that are causing harm to people without necessarily even being noticed or accused.
Yes. Let me give you an example from a little bit ironic. Irony is, of course, aimed at myself, from my own personal experience. When I was going to psychoanalysis some 20 years ago, I remember I was there talking all the time, like crazy, obsessional neurotic. And then I realized why I was doing it. I was talking all the time to the analyst, not because I wanted to achieve something, but I was afraid that if for a brief moment I stop talking, the analyst may ask me a really tough question. So I was talking all the time just so that things would stay the way they are, not to disturb my fragile psychic balance and so on and so on. This is what I would have called pseudo-activity. You are active all the time, but not really in order to change something, but to make it sure that things will stay the way they are. And my sad conclusion is that quite a lot of radical politics, not only on the left, but even on the right, functions in this way. For example, the last Republican National Convention. All this talk about change, you know, candidates of change and so on. I think it basically means let's change some things, let's talk about change so that nothing will really change.
So it's a distraction from fundamental change.
No, yes, a distraction, but not in this superficial sense that, you know, some evil agent who controls everything wants to distract us. It's a distraction, how should I put it, built into the system itself.
So it happens unconsciously.
Yeah, but again, let's not give to this word unconsciously some kind of ominous Freudian meaning. You know, although I am trained even as a psychoanalyst, I'm very skeptical about all too quick use of psychoanalysis in explaining properly social phenomena. No wonder many old-style Marxists today love psychoanalysis. Why? Because it enables them, namely the reference to psychoanalysis, to avoid asking the truly hard question of what is wrong with their own analysis. And Marxists will explain to you, we know what's going on, imperialism, post-colonialism, whatever, and then you ask him, okay, why then there is no revolutionary movement? He will tell you, oh, ask the Freudians. They will explain it to you, the libidinal manipulations, and so on and so on. No, it's an easy way to avoid the tough questioning. So I wouldn't talk so much about, to answer to your question, about the unconscious, but rather about, I wouldn't even call it subliminal message, a message inscribed into or contained into the very form of the explicit ideological message. If I may, and stop me if I talk too much, let me give you a popular example from a popular culture.
Sure.
Recently I saw a wonderful old Hollywood leftist film, John Carpenter's They Live from 88, which stages ideology at its most elementary. It's the story of a guy who stumbles upon some strange sunglasses, and what does he see? When you put these strange sunglasses on, you see ideological reality, like where, with our ordinary eyes, we see just a big publicity poster telling us, go to Hawaii, have a trip of your lifetime, there a new honeymoon, and so on. When you put these glasses on, you see the message, reproduce, enjoy, don't think, obey, whatever. So we should always ask, what is this message, subliminal ideological message contained in the explicit message? My big crown example would have been here, charity. We are all the time bombarded with appeals to charity, like for a price of one cappuccino, you can save a kid starving in Africa, whatever. But what's the message? What would we have seen if we were to put on these ideological glasses? I think something like, don't think, pay a little bit and buy cheaply your piece of your conscience. It's basically a kind of almost superstitious activity. Pay a little bit so that you don't have to worry about it. I think it's even the same, frankly, about ecological propaganda, I worry. I mean, I don't underestimate. I think we are approaching catastrophe. But how does this ordinary upper middle class politically correct green movement function? You know, like buy organic food and so on and so on. What do you really achieve when you buy organic fruits, for example? I doubt very much if it really has an impact on your health or on environment. I think it's mostly the ideological profit which matters. It makes you feel good. It makes you that you participate, that you are doing in something, you are doing something for the earth, and so on and so on. It's this typical late consumerist attitude of the point of our consumption of commodities. It's not only they satisfy our needs, also not only the keeping up with the Joneses, that is to say status symbol, but it's, as they put it, the New Agers, a way of realizing our true self, of living a meaningful, politically correct life, and so on and so on. So you see here, it's not unconscious in any substantial way. It's just we should be aware of when you do something like charity, which in itself, of course, it's not bad. I'm not saying let the poor children in Africa drop dead, but what comes included into the price? What are we buying with it?
So it's more of a way of assuaging our guilt than anything else.
Yeah, absolutely, yes. That's, I think, is the entire logic of charity. And another point to it, here I'm talking about as kind of old-fashioned Marxist. It's also about depoliticizing the situation. For example, did you notice how the discourse of the media changed in the last, I would say, 5 years? Before, it was the leftists who were repeating all the time, we in our developed societies live in an ivory tower of relative affluence. What about the people out there starving and so on? Now, the big figures of the establishment tell all the time, are we aware what goes on in Africa, Congo, and so on, starvation, slaughters? But I think the message of this is, the basic message is to depoliticize the situation. It's, let's forget our ideological conflicts, capitalism, socialism, whatever. People are starving there. So again, don't think, act. So I think, strangely, social activism today is more and more in the service of the establishment. It's act, don't think.
So does that mean that there is no such thing as a genuine benevolent intention?
Of course there is, but I think things are not decided at this level. You can be privately a very benevolent person. This, I think, is incidentally the part of my book to which you kindly referred, Violence, which I like most. I think, maybe I'm wrong, it's the second chapter where I confront the truly difficult question, which is how somebody who can be as a person, extremely honest and so on, can nonetheless do horrible things. And I'm here very much self-critical. For example, one of my favorite books is for social criticism is Brian Victoria, I think I quote it in the book, Zen at War. It asks a very simple but I think deeply appropriate question. What was the attitude of the Zen Buddhist community in Japan in the 30s and 40s. The shocking result is that not only were they fully supporting Japanese war efforts, invasion of China and so on, they were even justifying it in Buddhist terms, like basically telling people how to do the dirty job of killing without feeling guilty, without getting involved in it. The idea is if you overcome your false self, your false sense of substantial self-identity, then you no longer perceive yourself as culpable. You become, in a way, a neutral observer of your own acts. Or as the guy who was very popular in the 60s, the hippie hero, D.T. Suzuki, the Zen Buddhist popularizer, put it in his slightly different article from late 30s. It's not your sword which is killing the enemy. You just observe your sword moving in the air and the enemy gets stuck onto it or something like that. So my point is that Suzuki undoubtedly was an authentic Buddhist. His mystical experience was the real thing. But nonetheless, this did not prevent him doing or collaborating in horrible things. As they would have put it in X-Files, you know, the truth is out there in what you do, not in what you think. I think if you focus on your inner intentions and so on, I have absolutely no doubts that you would discover a heart of gold in Stalin, in Hitler. They all liked small children, cats. They were Hitler-like to give small cakes to children. Stalin liked to receive young girls and so on and so on. Everybody is, if you look deeply inside, a good guy. That doesn't interest me.
Slavoj Žižek is my guest. He's professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. His new book is called Violence. We'll talk more about his ideas after this break. You're welcome to get on the phone and join us. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Up next, we will talk about the only legitimate source of violence in the world. Many times it is the state. Just a minute, and we'll be back.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Slavoj Žižek. He is professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. His new book is called simply Violence. If you want to join our conversation, send email to think at kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. I want to talk a little bit about the issue of systemic violence, which is violence that occurs due to political systems and economic systems. Do you believe the existence of civilization and governments has actually made humans more violent rather than less?
No, the problem is both at the same time. The problem is that every containment of diminishment of violence has to rely on a kind of a counter-violence and generates a violence of its own. It's the same. Let me give you a parallel example, a homology from field which is more properly my own psychoanalysis. We all know we have illicit desires which are oppressed, censored, and so on. But the problem of psychoanalysis is that often the very activity of oppression, when we try to control, repress our illicit pleasures, and so on, as it were, gets contaminated by what it tries to oppress. Remember, for example, this is the typical masochist ritual, where masochist ritual is basically, to put it in simple terms, you want to punish yourself, to check your illicit impulses, to excessive, perverse, whatever, enjoyment, but then you start to enjoy the very punishment. So you cannot get rid of this excessive stain. And I think something is always co-substantial with state violence. It is supposed to, by its monopolization of violence, to control illegitimate, private, however we call it, violence, but at the same time, it involves, it has to rely on an excess of what I call illegitimate obscene violence. In social theory, from the right to the left, on the right, Carl Schmitt, the Nazi law philosopher, on the left, Walter Benjamin, they were aware, well aware of this excess, which Benjamin called the violence which is not just sustaining the law, but also founding the law. That is to say, even if we have, to put it in simple terms, the most transparent, democratically legitimized government, in order for government, or more broadly, state power, to truly function, to be accepted as authority, at some implicit level, the message between the lines should always be, no matter all the legitimizations, basically, we can do with you whatever we want. It has to be this excess. And this is what fascinates me tremendously in my work. All these excessive, obscene forms, which can be, on the one hand, the Dick Cheney topic, that is to say, the dark side, the things we have to do secretly, but somebody has to do them heroically, up to the obscene rituals, like this sexualized masochistic ritual in U.S. Army, in all other armies, and so on. This obscene underside, which is not publicly recognized, but it's necessary for the state power and its apparatuses to reproduce itself.
So a lot of Americans would look at this and say, okay, well, the state is the only sort of legitimate source. It's the only thing that's able to claim a legitimate right to violence in the state. But isn't there a difference in outcomes depending on whether we give that power to the state or the state takes it by force?
I think that precisely, de facto, if you look how a state apparatus effectively functions, this difference gets blurred. We may live under the illusion that we give it to them, but the state basically takes it. And we are entering here a very refined area where we cannot do a simplistic analysis of just opposing, let's say, democratic to totalitarian regimes or whatever. For example, let me give you a provocative statement. How do our liberal democracies function? Basically, I claim people do not really decide. They even don't want to decide. What happens is that it's a weird pact between people and, let's call them, power establishment. As already Walter Lippmann knew in his famous book Public Opinion from 1922, my God, people want to be told what they want to be told what to choose, but they want the appearance of being allowed themselves to choose. If people are not somehow told what to choose, then It's not normal democracy when people really have to choose. It's more even a crisis of democracy. So again, you know, here my psychoanalytic training comes into the game, as it were. One has, without any illusions, one has to look how things effectively function. And here, again, things get very blurred. I mean, for example, I'm not here just playing some kind of anti-totalitarian game, claiming every power is totalitarian. Even many leftists who like to protest and so on are here often way too short. It's easy to have this enthusiasm for leftist protest, fighting state power, oppressive apparatuses. But are we aware to what extent this very activity presupposes state security, police, and so on? All these leftist protest activities are only possible when public law and order is somehow guaranteed.
Is there somehow, I mean, the alternative would seem to be from either having a state or having anarchy. I mean, is that any kind of alternative?
That's a good question. I still remain an old-fashioned, here at least, Marxist. I claim that sooner or later, precisely in order to cope with the problems we are approaching now, really hard problems, from ecology to biogenetic challenge and so on, that we, by we, I mean very bombastically, all people, humanity, will have to invent a new mode of collective action, which will be neither, let's call it vaguely, the market activity of individuals pursuing their interests, neither that nor the state activity. If there is a lesson to be drawn, is that state in itself, state as the state apparatus, neither state nor market can solve these problems. But again, my book is not so much, let me make this point clear, a critique of violence. If anything, attentive readers got this point very well. It's a reappraisal, even a plea for the correct type of violence. I claim that our, especially in the developed West, situation which is characterized precisely by a tremendous fear of violence, a kind of excessive sensitivity to violence, best exemplified by the predominant political correctness and at the same time fear of harassment. What does it mean, harassment? It's a very ambiguous notion. Of course, I'm against harassment when we have, and we usually do have, clear states of, I don't know, sexist violence, racist violence, and so on. But at the same time, there is something which makes me very uneasy with regard to harassment. It is as if the message is, whenever another human being with his, her, their mode of enjoyment, and so on, comes too close to me, intrudes too much my private space, it's harassment. Basically, I claim the message of the fear of being harassed is remain at a proper distance towards me. Or paradoxically, insofar as we deal with harassment as a mode of intolerance, what we call tolerance is, I think, a strange misnomer. Tolerance basically means don't harass me. Let's tolerate each other, which means let's keep each other at a proper distance. Tolerance means precisely its opposite, de facto. It means I don't tolerate your over proximity. I want a proper distance.
Yeah, you write about
this generates violence in itself. Again, we are back at the standard topic. Sorry, I interrupted you.
That's okay. No, I think I interrupted you. Yeah. You write about the fact that you know, we do a lot of questioning as to whether or not we have a right as a society to act violently against people who have committed these grave offenses. You say we ought to question, at least as an exercise, whether or not we have the right to be merciful to those who have violated other people's rights.
Yeah, but nonetheless, how should I put it? I do raise these questions, but I want to nonetheless to distanciate myself strongly from the standard multiculturalist tolerant attitude, which is endlessly haunted with these problems of we are part of our culture. Do we have any right to judge others? How can we be sure that we don't impose onto others our own Eurocentric, Western, whatever, values, which are then masked as universal values? I think that this is not a correct even description of our reality. Our reality is a universal world. We do live as part of a universal civilization. Capitalism is no longer a Eurocentric cultural phenomenon. Capitalism is an anonymous, let's say, economic matrix, machine, which runs, finds its way in totally heterogeneous cultures. So when I speak about a universal culture in which we live, I don't mean universal in the sense of, we are all part of universal families. I mean universal in the sense of how we as individuals relate to ourselves as universal. Isn't it that in our so-called permissive society of choice, even our ethnic belonging, our sexual orientation, not to mention our profession, and so on and so on, we experienced it as something we have chosen and we can change our choice. So we are not identified with any of our particular cultural formations and so on and so on. I think that our basic experience today is how our particular roots, cultural background, is something ultimately contingent. So we are already part of a universal civilization.
Slavoj Žižek is my guest. His book is called Violence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Wosu in Grand Prairie. Hi, Wosu.
Yes, hi. How are you today?
Fine, thank you.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Yeah, my question is, do culture, religion, and environment influence people the way they react to violence? For instance, you have more conflict in Africa. Do that have to do with the environment or culture or religion?
Thanks for your call.
You're welcome.
It's a nice question. Only I'm very glad that the member of the public mentioned Africa, because precisely Africa is nonetheless, I think, a place where it would have been much too simple to just put the blame on local cultural traditions and so on and so on. Let's take the case of Congo, not Brazzaville, but the ex-Kinshasa Zaire, Republic of Congo, which is, I think, maybe the site of the greatest absolute humanitarian catastrophe of the last decades. It was part of the cover story of Time magazine 2 years ago, where they showed how at least 4 million people died in the last 10 years of unnatural causes there. Nobody cares about it. Why? It's simply not in the media, in the same way that Darfur, West Bank, or whatever are. Because, again, it's not for reasons of local culture. There is great violence there, but maybe local traditions nonetheless interact with the way Congo is perfectly, precisely in its present disarray. It even doesn't really function as a state. Local areas are dominated by local warlords. As such, it is perfectly integrated into global economy. Because these local warlords then all make deals about how to exploit the great mineral and other natural resources of Congo. They make a deal with big international companies whom this situation, where there is no state control and so on, fits them perfectly. So here you have a situation where it's all too easy to put blame on the local culture. You know, if you ask me, I think that local cultures are, and goes also even more for every religion, are very, very multiform, ambiguous things. Look, Islam, you can find in it everything you want, from very warlike attitude to the greatest tolerance. And Islam in history was sometimes the harshest regime, I mean Islamic states, sometimes like in Europe till in 18th, 19th century, Turkey was incredibly, breathtakingly more multiculturally tolerant than Western Europe at that time. So what I'm saying is that there is an element of opportunism here. Yes, you can find roots for everything. You can find causes and reasons. You can find them in a tradition for all possible attitudes. So I would say, yes, there are some cultural predispositions and so on, but they are always plastic. Basically, you want to do something, you look back and you find for sure something in your culture to legitimize it. So to take the extreme example, that's why I mentioned Suzuki before. To us, sometimes in the West, it appears that our civilization is too aggressive, our Judeo-Christian tradition and Buddhism has a more organic, holistic attitude. Wait a minute, we have the cruelest regimes also justified in Buddhist terms. Anything goes here.
We have an email from GK who asks, instead of defining violence, would you define nonviolence? And is it the answer to violence at the personal, societal, or even national levels?
Well, there are, because violence is a multiple diverse phenomenon. It's not a consistent phenomenon. Of course, the answers are here, multiple answers. But about nonviolence, I would say that, again, we have to define precisely what we mean. Let's take, now I will try to propose to clarify this point, a provocative example. Let's take Mahatma Gandhi. His big motto was nonviolent resistance. But from my standpoint, he was extremely violent, but violent in a good sense. What he did was he didn't just protest. Through organizing, economic boycotting, mass demonstrations, the aim was precisely to stop the British colonial machinery functioning. In a way, it was a very violent intrusion into the normal functioning of society. In a way, he was, and I well know what I'm talking about, but just to make it clear that I'm not demonizing violence, I claim that in a way one can say, at a substantial social level, that Gandhi was more violent than Hitler. Hitler was, of course, subjectively extremely violent, disgusting, killing millions. But why was Hitler so violent? Here I remain an old Marxist. He was so violent precisely because this was the only way to basically keep things the way they are, not to disturb the basic coordinates of the capitalist order and so on and so on. Hitler's violence was reactive. So in a way, yes, Gandhi was more violent than Hitler. He didn't kill any people, but he disturbed more radically the existing social system.
Slavoj Žižek is my guest. He's professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. His new book is called Violence. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. You can get on the line to join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. The worlds of Manet, Miro, Marx, and Macbeth are yours to explore. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Slavoj Žižek. His new book, Violence, offers six sideways reflections on the subject. You can join us at 800-933-5372. Slavoj, you spoke a moment ago about the violence of Gandhi in a sort of positive way and the way that he affected real change. On the other hand, you think it may be violent in a negative way to seek deeper meaning in things like human tragedy and suffering. Can you talk about that?
Here we touch the theological core of my thinking. Many people are surprised why I find such a sympathy for the basic legacy of the Judeo-Christian tradition. But I think it's a necessary precondition of any true emancipatory meaning. What do I mean by this? For me, one of the greatest books of the Bible, the first treatise on critique of ideology, is the book of Job. What happens there? Bad things happen to Job, and then the three theological friends come. And the lesson of each of them is, your suffering has a deeper meaning. The first one says, basically, God is just, so if you suffer, you must have done something wrong, even if you don't know what it is. The second one says, even if you didn't do anything wrong, God is maybe testing you or whatever. The point is, your suffering has a deeper meaning. The greatness of Job is not that he claims that he is innocent. He just claims, no, what hit me, all these catastrophes, don't have any meaning. I resist to assume they have a meaning. And at the end, as we know, God appears and gives full right to Job. He says, whatever you said is right. Whatever other guys, theologists are saying, who are apparently appear to advocating me, defending me, are wrong. And I claim that to grasp properly the death of Christ on the cross, one has to see it as a repetition of Job's suffering, as is well known to intelligent theologists. What happens on the cross? Which God? What kind of God dies on the cross? I think it's precisely the God which is the ultimate guarantee, you know, the big guy who is sitting back and secretly pulls the strings. The guy whose logic is best rendered by, I find it very disgusting, metaphor of stain and the whole picture, you know. Like they say, what appears to us as evil is just a stain, which is seen as a stain if you look at a picture from too close. Like you have a beautiful picture, you look at it from half an inch, you see just stains. You withdraw to 1-2 feet, you see how those, what you saw as stains, contribute to the global harmony. And that's the standard teleological version, that what appears to us, finite mortals, as evil, stains, in unknowing way, contributes to global harmony. This logic breaks down with Christ's sacrifice. And I think this is the message for us. I mean, are we really able to say that the millions who died in Holocaust, the millions who died in Stalinist Gulag, the millions who died in colonial wars, who are now dying in Congo, that these are just stains from our finite perspective, but somehow they contribute to a global meaning, to global beauty of the universe? No, Christ's sacrifice is for me a desperate act. It's the act, it's a kind of confession that we will not get God's help. It's not trust God. God trusts us. The message is, I cannot control the situation. It's up to you, Holy Spirit. Holy Spirit, which means, let's not forget, the community of believer, you are free. I, as it were, pass the torch onto you. So I think it's an extremely progressive, radical idea. As intelligent theologists, again, claim that the deepest message of Christianity is not do your proper things well and you can count on God. No, God is counting on us. It's a very radical message.
So when, Slavoj, do you think we have an obligation to be violent?
Well, it's not so much. First, there is no a priori answer to this. I don't think that we can approach it. We have an obligation to violence to be very simple. Whenever the what we are attacking is, however you put it, a system of oppression, exploitation, and so on and so on. Even if this system appears to be peaceful in the sense of just calmly reproducing itself, we have full right to react violently to its dark matter, invisible violence. I don't have any problems here. I think even one is even, I don't have any problems here, even with asserting that a certain degree of what appears to our sensitivities as not democratically legitimized violence is permissible. Because, you know, with democracy, one should always ask what kind of democracy, where. For example, my big example would have been here, and one of my few true political heroes today is Haiti Jean-Bertrand Aristide. I think he is my political ideal. While respecting all democratic rules and so on, he did a little bit more. The way his democratically elected government interacted or relied on the mobilization of poor people and so on, this was too much, which is why he had to be twice overthrown. And it's very indicative how all enemies immediately joined hands. Like, remember, this was just after the disagreement on Iraq war, when France and United States, even Brazil, Lula government, they all agreed Aristide had to disappear. He practiced this kind of violence. By violence, I don't mean killing people, I mean an additional pressure from self-organized people.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Bernie in Frisco. Hello, Bernie.
Hi, good afternoon. Every 4 years in this country, we conflate a fear of violence with a fear of protest or peaceful assembly. We do it at both the Republican and Democratic conventions, by pushing people who would protest and peacefully assemble off to the side. Mayor Bloomberg did it in 2004. It's been done now. It's an expressed fear, which I think is a false expression of fear that these people are going to be violent. I acknowledge that some store windows may be broken, there may be some fistfights, but they are not concerned with the violence. They say they are. They are concerned because they do not want peaceful assembly and protest. They do not want dissent. And please answer this if you can.
Thanks for your call, Bernie. Okay.
Oh, I mean, it's not even to answer. I just would like to say that I not only fully agree with you, but this precisely, I claim, is a perfect example of how we are effectively far from living in a truly permissive society where basically you can do whatever you want and so on and so on and so on. You touched upon a very important question, upon the invisible in the sense that they are not explicitly formulated, or if formulated, they are formulated in a incomprehensible legal terms, limits to our freedom. What freedoms? What you describe, these peaceful protests, would be exactly the U.S. equivalent to those self-organizations of the people on which Aristide was relying. And I think that the underlying logic of those in power, it's not very mysterious. I think, in a way, everything is said. You just have to watch the movies, I would say. This is where my fascination with Hollywood comes. Like, let's take the biggest hit of the last year, The Dark Knight, the new Batman movie. I think it's a perfect example of where ideologically we stand today. First, I find it very suspicious, the very humanization of the hero. I hope many viewers have noticed how it's not only this last installment of Batman series, but it's the same with Superman, with Spider-Man, how, as the critics usually put it, we get a hero who is no longer just a flat, cartoon-like character, but has anxieties, doubts, uncertainties, you know, as if this makes it somehow more human. No, I think this is the fundamental ideological mechanism, the same as at the Republican Party. You see of Sarah Palin, all her children there, and so on and so on. I mean, I find it so ridiculous when Sarah Palin and John McCain accused opponents of manipulating in a sexist way her family. My God, she was manipulating them, bringing all them up on stage. Why? To blur the key debate, which is about the issues. It's the same with this humanization of heroes. But the second thing, which is much more interesting in The Dark Knight, I'm talking about, again, the movie, the last installment of Batman saga, is, did people notice that the movie basically, at the end, at least if we read the plot literally, legitimizes lying? The message is, the policeman about whom we thought throughout the film is a good guy, is a bad guy, a killer, but the dignity of the public power edifice should be maintained, sustained, so Batman heroically assumes the crimes in order to save the dignity of the state apparatus. It's a film which basically confirms the need to lie, that the state power is based on a lie and we should heroically sustain it. It's a very sad message.
An email from Catherine in Fort Worth says, I was recently reading Jean Baudrillard on the deterrence caused by a universal fear of nuclear war, a threat of violence which controls our lives but which can never actually be enacted precisely because of its role in controlling ideology. How do your ideas on violence or on the fear of harassment and the need for political correctness relate to this idea of simulated threat?
The problem with simulated threat is that why is it evoked? To justify violent activity, military preparations, and so on, from our side, which are far from simulated. I mean, it's clear that in order to justify your own mobilization, you need to evoke a violent threat. Okay, but that's a standard topic, and to avoid a misunderstanding, I'm not saying that the terrorist threat is just imagined in this way. It's much more complex. But what I would definitely like to touch upon here, when we are talking about the threat of violence, and so on, are some other, even more fundamental levels of violence. Let's go for a moment to symbolic violence, which really interests me. For example, that I think we are in the middle of the changes in how we talk about things, in what can be said, what cannot be said, which are deeply indicative. For example, up to a year or two ago, I noticed, basically, the fears of global warming were dismissed by those in power, big corporations, government, as apocalyptic exaggerations of ex-leftists and so on, unrealistic. Now, all of a sudden, we hear more and more a totally different discourse, which says, okay, global warming is a fact, but let's also look at the positive sides. In Greenland, they are already growing vegetables. If the Arctic ice melts down, we will have a direct ship connection between Asia and United States, and so on and so on. What worries me is how what appeared a couple of years ago, a catastrophe, is now, as it were, normalized. This strange shifts in public ideology is what worries me, when literally the impossible becomes possible. As I already said, a couple of years ago, nobody would even have dared to talk about torture. Now we talk about torture. It's how things which were considered, again, unimaginable are now simply accepted as a fact.
And who's in charge of those shifts? Does it come again
No, it's a spontaneous process. One should radically reject here any old-fashioned leftist paranoia. You know, like this idea, if you read old leftist essays from the first part of the 20th century, they sometimes read as if somewhere midway between Washington, that is to say the government, and Wall Street, that is to say New York, they meet every month, you know, the guys who really decide and pull the strings and so on and so on. No, the system doesn't need this. The system functions quite well without the agent who, in the background, as it were, who pulls the strings there. The violence truly is systemic in the sense of anonymity. But you know what's the problem? The problem I see is the following one. In the good old, I mean it ironically, Marxist days, the progressives were able to at least claim, now we know it was false, that, how should I put it, history is on their side, that they are sitting on the train of history. You know, we are just fulfilling historical necessity which pushes us towards communism and so on and so on. Now, unfortunately, we no longer can claim that. If the system is left to itself, it will probably bring us into some kind of, towards some kind of nightmarish society of ecological catastrophe, biogenetic catastrophe, and so on. We have to act against the grain.
Slavoj Žižek is professor of philosophy and psychoanalysis at the European Graduate School. His new book is called Violence. Slavoj, it's been such an interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
I'm just sad that we don't have more time. And my greetings to Dallas-Fort Worth. If nothing else, it's the area where my favorite writer of the 20th century, the detective writer Patricia Highsmith, was born. So I love the city.
Very nice. Thank you.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.